Accession number 8736, room number 19.
Lord Harding, take 19. So did you find this satisfying, you know, to have this opportunity to put your ideas into practice?
Well, yes, I think I did, in the light of subsequent events. I found it was pretty hard work, because there was a good deal of difference of opinion about the way the army should fight its battles. And we had a great deal of argument and discussion, of course, but gradually out of discussion, I think we made progress, and the subsequent events proved that that was useful. Yes, I think so. You get frightfully busy and on these things, and you don't really feel at the time whether you're satisfied with it or not. I think probably I wasn't satisfied. But I thought probably we were getting on as best we could. I didn't have all the resources I wanted. It was difficult to get instructors, get people made available by units for instruction and that sort of thing. I mean, a commanding officer doesn't readily give up his best officers or NCOs to go as teachers. But you must have really good chaps, and chaps with experience at all levels.
Was there a great deal of competition at that time with the various theatres of war, you know, for getting the right sort of people? How did your area, the Western Desert, how did that relate to other theatres in order of priority?
I think we were rather jealous of our own position. In fact, I'm sure we were. And we looked upon people who had, weren't at all, had got white knees and weren't sunburned and hadn't got sand in their ears as quite useless. But of course, there was no serious fighting going on anywhere else at that time. And so we looked upon ourselves as a class of our own, and then we thought we knew all about it, and that anybody coming out had a lot to learn.
How about this term, the Desert Rats? Who were the Desert Rats?
The Desert Rats are originally the 7th Armoured Division, because the Jalabur is the Desert Rat. And that was it's a little rat, and that was the divisional sign. The 7th Armoured Division sign is the Jalabur, which is the Desert Rat. And the Desert Rat was originally applied simply and solely to the 7th Armoured Division, and they were rather jealous of it, or in fact very jealous of it. And when it gradually became spread to other people, when I was commanding 7th Armoured Division, we just turned up our noses at other people. I mean, there was one division which had a boar. It was always known as the pregnant pig. there was a good deal of competition and jealousy. And then I think, not dangerous jealousy, but, jealousy to compete. And certainly this was the case in the pursuit for Mellemere. My division and 1st Armoured Division were very jealous of each other.
In these disputes you were mentioning, you know, regarding training and the various tactics, can you remember any particular supporter of your position, or anyone whose views coincided with yours? How about Auchinleck, for instance?
Well, I don't remember his taking any very great personal interest, or he certainly didn't take up a position in any argument about methods or future. I don't remember his doing so. I had a very good team. my four chaps. There was a chap called Hughes, who was an infantryman, who'd been in the desert. There was a chap called George Collingwood, who had been right through the desert and was with ADC to Dick O'Connor in the first campaign. There was another, I can't remember his name now, Sapper, who'd served in the desert. And somebody else, I can't remember who, yes, I think that's about all. There were four officers of about Lieutenant Colonel rank, who all of whom had served in the desert. And together they made a very good team, and they were representative of all arms. And the one Indian Army chap, I can't remember what was his name. He'd been G1 of the 7th, the 4th Indian Division. Organization of the armor. And Dick McCreary had come out as I don't know what they call it, director, armored. He was a senior armored officer at GHQ and responsible for advising the commander in chief on all questions to do with the armor. And he and Auchinleck didn't agree about a number of things, particularly about organization. Auchinleck wanted, I think, to reorganize the whole army into composite divisions, each with its armored component. And Dick McCreary thought otherwise. So I didn't get really involved at that stage in all that argument about actually organization of formations, although, of course, I was very interested in it. And I think there was a definite antipathy, really, between McCreary and Auchinleck. Dick McCreary, I knew him very well because we'd been students at the Staff College together, and I had very high regard for him. He was a cavalry soldier, of course, and had a different approach and outlook from some people. But I wasn't really directly involved in any. I was much more concerned at that time with the training. As a tactical training at all levels. But then, as time went on, and I think it was during that sometime, early summer, I suppose it must have been, of 42, the staff at GHQ was reorganized, and Dorman Smith was brought in as a deputy chief of staff for operations and intelligence, and I was made deputy chief of staff for organization, equipment, and training. And so at that stage, I did come into the whole of the argument about the organization. And I think, looking back on it now, my view at the time was what was needed was to retain the armored division formations as such, and also retain the distinction between armored divisions and infantry divisions. And that was my view at that time. Dick McCreary, I think, also held the same view. I think the AUK was rather, and Dorman Smith were rather inclined to think that east of it, they ought to have a number of homogeneous mixed divisions with armor and infantry. At that time, I didn't hold that view. I'm not sure, looking back on it all, that I was right. From subsequent experience, certainly in Italy later on. But anyway, that was what the argument was all about at that time. But my memory is a bit hazy about it all, because I was rarely primarily interested in the tactical training of the units, the individuals, the units, and the formations.
How did you get on with Dorman Smith? You know, what sort of
he was a senior, senior to me at the Staff College, so I didn't know him very well then. He When I during the first campaign, when I was with O'Connor, he, Dorman Smith, was the commandant of the Middle East Staff College at Haifa, and he used to come up to the desert now and again and discuss things with O'Connor and myself, and he had a lot of forward-looking ideas, or quite a few. But I thought at the time that he carried them too far, and I wasn't sure. He'd been director of training in India when Leok was commander-in-chief, and Auchinleck had thought the tremendous world of him from a training and a tactical point of view and that sort of thing. I look at it this way, and I may be wrong. I think Auchinleck, having done all his service with the Indian Army, and then having come into the war, and first of all being involved with Norway, and then coming out to the Middle East, I think he was quite determined that whatever he did, he wasn't going to be go down to history as a blimp. And that made him very susceptible to Dorman Smith's ideas, both tactical and strategic, I suppose. And I think Dorman Smith was allowed his imagination to run riot, to get away with him. In particular, it came to a head later on when Auchinleck went up to command the army himself, and Dorman Smith went with him and was his principal staff officer in that respect. And I think that he, let me put it this way. I had come to the conclusion by then that Dorman Smith's ideas were out of keeping and too far in advance of what the army was able and prepared to carry out. And, for example, take the regimental system. I think Chink Dorman Smith thought that the regimental system were outdated, and that the whole army ought to be more flexible and the people ought to be prepared to move units from this brigade to that brigade and so on and so on and so forth. And I think by the time that the army got back to Ellerman, it was in a state of complete muddle and disorganization. And I think that was very largely due to Dorman Smith's influence on Auchinleck. And so I thought he had by that time, I think, become a menace.
What was happening in the desert while you were training?
Well, there was the offensive, the Rommel's third offensive, against the Gazala position. and Tobruk, which ended in the Eighth Army being defeated and driven back to El Alamein. And that all went on while I was at GHQ trying to bring training up to date throughout that time. So I had no hand in those operations, and
did it give an impetus to what you were doing?
Oh yes, very much so, because it was. It looked as if, it developed in a very serious way, and it looked as if there's going to be some question of whether Rommel wouldn't succeed in getting into the Delta. So it was a very anxious time. It gradually got more anxious. I think after the fighting at Gazala, when the army was defeated and driven back, and then Tobruk surrendered, it began to look very dicey indeed. And I was worried at the time that the El Alamein position had never been properly prepared, because in the Rommel's second offensive, I had made a recommendation, or put a paper, to a note to my general, who puts it on to GHQ, saying that the Alamein position ought to be prepared as a final fallback position for the defence of the Delta. And very little, if anything, was done about it. I remember drawing a map. You see, the Alamein, the position at Alamein is pretty well the shortest distance between the coast and the Qatari Depression. And it was, essentially, the final, last defensive position that anyone could hold and maintain control of the Delta and the canal. And I thought at that time had urged that it should be prepared, and then I got caught up with a lot of other things, so I personally don't think I did any more about it. I ought to have done. But then we were successful in driving Rommel back and so on. Well, when Rommel's offensive against the Gerala position was successful, and the French were driven out of Mekele, he was Tobruk surrendered, and the whole front was in a state of flux, and units were all mixed up, and the morale of individuals, people get sometimes get it wrong, I think, in talking about the Eighth Army. The morale of the Eighth Army had gone, had lost their morale. Well, I don't, what had happened really was, I think that morale within units, within good units, was as good as ever it was. But the morale of the army as a whole was shattered because they were in a state of muddle and confusion and had been defeated. And so they were forced back to Alamein, and it took some time to sort out the Alamein position. All that happened while I was away. And the next set of events, as far as I'm concerned, was when Alexander Monte came out. Well, I was still trying to carry out my responsibilities as director, deputy chief of staff, with responsibility for training, organization, and equipment. And I was rather fed up at that time because Dorman Smith was Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations and Intelligence, and I think they claimed it was in the interest of security, but I wasn't, in my job, I wasn't allowed to attend what then became called morning prayers, which was the meeting the Commander-in-Chief had to discuss the general situation and decide on what's to be done about it and who would do what. And I was excluded from that. I said on the grounds of security, which seemed to me to be all wrong, so I was rather disgruntled. But I was going on with doing what I could, and reinforcements were arriving. Certainly one, two, another armored division, so-called, another infantry division. So there was plenty to do, both on the training and on the equipment side, in order to get these new arriving formations kitted up with desert equipment and started off on training in desert warfare. So I had plenty to do, and although, I mean, looking back on it, I think I was a bit disgruntled at the time. In fact, I was. It didn't really make any difference to what I did. But then, I don't know when it was, sometime that summer, rumors started going round the place that Auchinleck was being replaced, and the Prime Minister with Alan Brooke was in Cairo. And so the rumors were very rife about what was happening. And then I heard that Alexander, who I didn't know, never met, and Monty, whom I did know well, were knocking about GHQ. And I still wasn't told what was going on. And then one day, one evening, one afternoon, I was sent for, I was told the Commander-in-Chief wants to see you. So I went along to the Commander-in-Chief's room, And I found Monty sitting in the Commander-in-Chief's chair and Alexander sitting on the desk beside him. And Monty said, "Oh, hello, John." I said, "You haven't met General Alexander." I said, "No, sir." And then he sat down and he said, "Well, look here. Sandy Galloway tells me that you know everybody out here and about all the formations." Sandy Galloway was working in the War Office at the time. And we'd been fellow students at the Staff College, so Monty knew him well. So he said, "I wanted to tell me all about everything." And I said, "Well, what, sir?" And he said, "Well, down to brigade level." And so I said, "Well, tell me about each formation and so on." And I gave him my assessment of the state and the of the troops and the command in each of the various formations down to brigade level. And from what I my own experience of them, I knew most of them pretty well by that time. And then he said, "Now, out of all this muckage, can you organize a corps of two armored divisions and one mobile infantry division? I want to form a corps de chasse," he called it then. I think that's the expression he used, I'm sure it was, a corps de chasse for a major offensive. And I thought for a moment, and then I said, "Well, sir, if you give me a little time, and if you don't mind my putting anything I suggest down on in my own handwriting, yes, I'll do that for you." And he said, "Well, General Alexander and I have got to go and see the ambassador. I'll be back in a couple of hours' time. I'd like to have it done." So I went back to my office and sat down. I called my orderly and locked the door and told him to tell anybody that I was not available. And I sat down and I worked out what I thought would be. I did say to him, and I suppose, sir, hold the front. At the same time, he said, "Oh yes, of course." I worked out what I thought would be a satisfactory, the best answer from my knowledge of the various formations that were available for that purpose. And that was the origin of what eventually was 10th Corps. And then I went back, and he came back, and I told it to him, and he took it away and said, "All right, well, we'll work on that." And that was that. And then he went off. He said, "I'm going out to take over 8th Army." I didn't know what Alexander was going to do. He never told me that. But I assumed that he was going to take over Commander-in-Chief. And that was my introduction to the new top structure.
How did you react to that?
Well, I don't know, just as one reacts to anything. Just sort of, you know, all in the day's work.
Did you think that there might be an improvement, though, in organisation?
Well, I don't remember. Yes, I suppose I did. I don't remember thinking anything other than what how the hell am I going to produce the answer to this, solve this conundrum? That's all I thought about at the time. I don't remember anything else. And then I worked it all out and showed it to Monty. And then he went off to command 8th Army. And Alexander, I didn't know what was going on. And Auchinleck, as I knew, was still in the knocking about the headquarters. Well, he was. And I suppose then I got used to get rung up by Freddie de Gangon, chief of staff to Monty, and asking for this and that and the other. And one evening he rang me up and said, "The army commander wants you to send out the 44th Division," which was one of the reserved, the new divisions that had come out from the UK. And they were outside Cairo at a camp called Katatba, about 20, 30 miles outside Cairo, but busy being, I was trying to re-equip them with desert equipment, and they were busy trying to get desert trained. And so I said to Freddie, "Well, I can't do that. I don't know. They're not trained." He said, "Well, you better have a word with the Army Commander." Well, Monty came on the line and said, John, I want the 44th Division sent out at once. I said, sir, but they're not trained. They're not desert trained. And there was a long pause at the end of the telephone. And then he said, well, they'll learn as they go, or something like that. And I didn't realize until afterwards, of course, that they'd been in his command at home, and he was responsible for their training in the UK. And that was the reason for the long pause, I suppose. Anyway, I said, well, sir, I must ask, I can't do this. I've tried to give you everything I can up to date, everything, given everything you've asked for as far as I can be able up to date. But I can't arrange for this division to come out without the Commander-in-Chief's approval. He said, well, you better go and get the Commander-in-Chief's approval, you see. So I went along to Corbett, who had taken over from Arthur Smith as Chief of Staff. And I told him what had happened. And he said, well, you know all about it. You better go and see the Commander-in-Chief and get an answer from him. I said, well, who is the Commander-in-Chief? So I didn't know. And he said, well, you better ask, see the Ork first. So I said, where's the Ork then? And he said, well, you'll find him talking to Dick Casey, who was then Minister of State in the Alley Building. So I went across to the Alley Building and found Dick Casey's office and knocked the door and walked in. And there was the Ork was discussing something or other with Casey. So I told him what the problem was. And he said, well, what does Alexander say? I said, well, I haven't asked him yet, sir. He said, well, you better ask Alexander. So I said, well, where is Alexander? He said, do you know where he is? He said, oh, I think he's at the embassy with the ambassador. So off I go. By this time, I'm getting a bit late. Off I go to the embassy, walk in, and there I find Alexander and Miles Lampson sitting on a sofa talking about pictures. So, at least I think that's what they were talking about. So I butted in and told Alexander what the problem was, and he said, well, what does Monty want? I said, he wants the 44th Division sent out at once. And I don't think they're ready to go in any case. I certainly don't think they should be used in anything other than a defensive role if they do go out. So he said, all right, well, if that's what Monty wants, tell him, let's arrange that. Send them out with the proviso or stiction or whatever you like to call it, that they should only be used in a defensive role until they get desert worthy. So I went back and rang up the 44th Division headquarters, talked to the chap called, what was his name, Hughes, I think, or something, I can't remember. And so, you better get out to 8th Army headquarters right away and report to the Army commander, because he, until you get your division, send your AQ into me, first thing at the crack of dawn, go into questions of providing your division with, as far as we can, with what they're short of in the way of desert equipment. Anyway, you better get out right away tonight and report to the Army commander, which he did. And he sent his AQ into me in the following day, and I spent the whole day with this chap, and I thought his name was Smith. I hadn't met him before. He was a colonel, you know, AQMG or whatever. And the time went on, we spent the whole day. And